The Industrial Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race. They have greatly increased the life expectancy of those of us who live in advanced countries, but they have destabilized society, have made life unfulfilling, have subjected human beings to indignities, have led to widespread psychological suffering, in the third world to physical suffering as well, and have inflicted severe damage on the natural world. The continued development of technology will worsen the situation. It will certainly subject human beings to greater indignities and inflict greater damage on the natural world. It will probably lead to greater social disruption and psychological suffering, and it may lead to increased physical suffering, even in advanced countries. We therefore advocate a revolution against the industrial system. This revolution may or may not make use of violence. It may be sudden, or it may be a relatively gradual process spanning a few decades. We can't predict any of that, but we do outline in a very general way the measures that those who hate the industrial system should take in order to prepare the way for a revolution against that form of society. This is not to be a political revolution. Its object will be to overthrow not governments, but the economic and technological basis of the present society. Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Jenny.
And today we are talking about our disagreements with the Unabomber.
Which, I think, at least for me anyway, are fewer than one might imagine. He actually had a lot of really good points.
True.
I think that his emphasis on revenge rather than productive, advancement of his goals an altered society was probably one of his main, drawbacks.
Okay, so Ted Kaczynski is driven by a very, very real problem, and that is this upcoming crisis of ecological collapse. And the problems with technology hobbling the human species, essentially. So I think it couldn't hurt to talk a little bit about what Ted Kaczynski said were some of the problems that he would like to attempt to remedy. Ted Kaczynski was against industrial civilization, obviously, but why?
Well, he listed out, when he, first started his activities as the Unabomber, he didn't, send notes or anything with any of his bombs that he was mailing people. He just, started mailing bombs to people and killed a few people and injured a whole bunch more. And everybody just thought he was just some random terrorist, and nobody really knew what the hell was going on until he finally sent a copy of his manifesto to the Washington Post and New York Times and said, "I'm gonna blow some people up if you don't publish this." And the Washington Post agreed to on the recommendation of the Attorney General and the Director of the FBI. It was actually the publishing of his. That publishing of his manifesto that led to him being captured, because I think it was his brother recognized his writing and contacted the FBI and was like, "Hey, I think this guy might be my brother."
It's a real bummer.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't worry, Jason. I wouldn't call the FBI on you.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
You say that now.
Yeah. I also think Jason probably wouldn't be mailing bombs to people, though. So
that's true. I probably wouldn't.
So I think my inclination is to say that, with anything, a person's stated motivations may not be the exact things that actually do motivate them. And I think that's probably the case with Kaczynski. I think at least in part his motivation was just a hatred of. A true, deeply felt hatred for the society that he lived in, and a love of wilderness. He was a super genius guy. He went to Harvard at 16 and made breakthroughs in boundary functions in his 20s. Taught in the math department at UC Berkeley when he was 25, which is apparently the youngest hire. In the university's entire history at that point. But then after that, he tried to go live in Montana in isolation, but without, you know, electricity or running water or whatever. But as civilization, society started encroaching on the area where he was living, he hiked out to, he said later on, he said that he hiked out to his favorite wild place from, to get away from it, and found a road that was cut through it. And it was at that moment that it just broke him. He couldn't tolerate, couldn't stand it any longer, and started enacting what he considered acts of revenge, and started mailing bombs to, like, university people, research departments, and I think also, like, airline industrialists or something like that.
And computer stores.
Right.
One of the things that he said that he was trying to do was to spark similar sorts of actions that would eventually bring down the technological and economic basis for the existence of industrial society. So he thought that if you blew up enough computer stores and research departments of major universities, capitalism and not capitalism, but you know, civilization would just collapse in on itself.
Yeah.
Which I find to be incredibly naive. It's a very, like, 1990s movie version of technology where it's like, oh no, they've hacked the internet, and it just shows like a little skull on the screen laughing. It says, it's like, ha ha ha. It's like virus.
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe it's naive, but mostly it's just out of touch, which is more or less a testament to the type of politics and ideology that folks like Ted Kaczynski, and I know we're going to touch a lot on, you know, primitivism and anti-civ folks, and those brands of anarchism.
I, in fact, hope to not touch on any of those.
Well, not touch on them personally, but certainly talking about them today. You know, like, yeah, maybe it was naive, but I think more than anything, it just is these sorts of politics, this sort of outlook, and certainly this kind of lifestyle leads you to be completely out of touch.
Well, I think, I think that Kaczynski was not, frankly, I don't think he's naive. I think that he wasn't actually trying to accomplish the destruction of civilization through his actions of sending those bombs. I think he was trying to get attention for himself and his cause, and I think that he was acting out just personal vengeance. Just, he was mad at these people for doing these things, and he wanted to hurt them, so he sent them bombs.
Right. I mean, that's what terrorism is, right? It's like the politics of frustration and desperation and of last resort. Like, reading a little bit about Kaczynski as a person, reading in the industrial society in his future, he largely regards people with contempt, you know? Like,
right.
He doesn't say the word sheeple, because that's like a thing that mostly we say as a way of making fun of, like, the Alex Jones crowd or whatever. But it's there's a lot in that attitude about, like,
mm-hmm.
You know, I think maybe the bomb started off as desperation and revenge, right? Just because of a lack of ideas. And then it started to become justified as, like, you have to, like, shock people out of their stupor and sort of prove to them that the things happening to them don't have to be, right? It's very, like, it's very falling down, like the Michael Douglas movie, you know, where it's just like everybody else is asleep and I'm the only one awake and I mm-hmm. can't take it anymore, kind of. And, like, so, you know, to contextualize a little bit, this is what, the late 70s through the mid 1990s, which is a pretty depressing time for anybody who has, like, a sense of needing to change the world. And there's, like, a corresponding rise of terrorism around the world, right? Like, this is the time of the Lockerbie hijacking and, the PFLP in Palestine and Badr Meinhof.
The Oklahoma City bombing.
The Oklahoma City bombing, right? This is the real golden age of terrorism, is precisely the period in which Kaczynski is mailing bombs around. So he turns out to be, rather than an anomaly, he's an anomaly only in that he's not a part of an organization.
Mm. But he's trying to inspire one, and frankly, I think well, I don't know if he necessarily individually inspired a movement, but or any particular organization, but certainly people sort of followed in his ideological footsteps. And in particular, I think the ITS is an actual organization that I think is very modeled on Kaczynski.
And what's directly. The ITS?
ITS is a terrorist organization located in primarily in Central America, and ITS is something in Spanish that translates roughly to individuals tending toward the wild, or something like that.
Oh right, yeah. And there's also the other one, the other group called Wild Reaction, which is very much influenced by Ted Kaczynski's reaction to his sacred places basically being destroyed. They kind of like emulate the same kind of response, an animalistic reaction to the destruction of the environment, right?
Mm.
Oh yeah, like that's like a term I came across a lot when reading was when people had their Kaczynski moment, their primal reaction, this sort of visceral from the gut kind of like, whatever the moment when they snap out of it or however you want to put it, but they refer to it
coming to Jesus moment.
Yeah, exactly. It's their Kaczynski moment is the moment when they pinpoint as the place where they depart, their point of rupture, right, from their one way of life to the other, where they come across their metaphorical, road through the path through the wild territory. So it's really similar politically to the nihilist movement in early 19th century Russia, right, the Narodniks. These are the people who were like, the Russian population is wholly enslaved and like enthralled to the Tsar and the Orthodox Church and have such low horizons that they can't be counted on to make a revolution like the way that the French, who have ideals of liberty and whatever. So the only thing you can really do is like assassinate a duke here, set off a bomb here, and hopefully like spark some small scale responses that like maybe one day leads to a conflagration, right? So this is like, it's got political origins, whether Kaczynski's aware of it or not, and maybe he writes it in the book, I didn't finish it. But he's really like utilizing a method which is pretty old school, right?
Yeah. Well, and I also think a central point of note in, you read through his manifesto is his absolute contempt for leftists. And his manifesto focuses almost entirely on like psychology and people's problems that modern society, the psychological problems that modern society creates. And so a lot of his criticisms of leftists are criticisms of the sort of psychological flaws of the types of people who tend to be leftists. Like, what is the psychological state of a person that gives rise to being a left-wing political activist? And he goes through and like analyzes these things. Some of it is like you could read the sections on like leftists and their two primary problems, feelings of inferiority and over socialization. You could read through those, and they frankly wouldn't be that different from like our criticisms of the left that we started this podcast with, you know?
I know. That's what I was thinking when I read those.
So, like, you know, Mark Fisher is a person who has a particular reaction to the like dominant academic liberalism inside of the scattered, confused post-Soviet left. And Kaczynski has a different response to the same thing, right?
Totally. Well, I think it goes deeper than that, though. I think it does. I think it goes deeper than that. There's an essence to anarcho-primitivism or anti-civ anarchy or whatever it is you want to sort of green art anarchy, whatever, however it is you want to frame it. The notion that civilization is the problem, civilization itself, taking the problem all the way down to the nature of technology, all the way back to the agricultural revolution, like that puts you in a position of saying that the left is wrong. It inherently puts you in a position of necessarily trying to transcend the left-right dichotomy. And I think this is where you get so much of the crossover with like third positionism and, you know, the left wing of fascism and, you know, green anarchists. There's this weird crossover area there that is inherent in rejecting leftist politics in favor of a criticism of civilization itself.
Right. I guess that makes sense. It's like similarly hearkening back to a romanticized version of the past.
Yeah, so I was going to say, it's not that weird. It's totally logically consistent.
Yeah, especially, I guess, when Kaczynski's, when the third positionism, it almost makes sense when you think about how much the left has identified with production and development. And, mm-hmm. you know, like, after a while, like, the whole communist movement gives up on the idea of world revolution and instead starts to point to, like, you know, the way in which the Warsaw Pact countries like raised living standards so rapidly after the Second World War, and like despite having been demolished, people have houses again, and like that's good, right? But they also have consumer goods, and like maybe a planned economy is a better way of growing an economy. And what really gets lost is the idea of the liberation of human beings from the enslavement of work,
right.
of time, of like regimented time and of intellectual stupor and drudgery. And so, like, you know, when you read Kaczynski, or, you know, when I was younger, when I was never very familiar with the green anarchy stuff, but I encountered it a little, and there was always something that spoke to me at like a very gut level, just like, yeah, like the stuff that they hate is, you know, it's school, it's work, it's traffic, it's cops, it's mm-hmm. it's all of the stuff that makes you feel like your very existence is being constantly like framed for you by forces so far outside your control that, I mean, what can you do other than, I don't know, blow it up or run away to the woods? Like, at a certain level, I can make sense of it, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So like the fascists were the first political movement that had ecology as part of its sort of platform.
Yeah.
The Italian fascists, and even more so the Nazi Germans, which, you know, the left didn't pick up until, you know, the 60s,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, and who was it? Teddy Roosevelt in the U.S. who founded, all of the major federal national parks.
Right, yeah.
He was a overt racist, openly advocated for the superiority of the white race and the necessity of the domination of the world by Western civilization. And he was a big conservationist.
And so I was reading about deep ecology, like as a sort of philosophy, and I was like looking at its origins, and everything that I could find said its origins were in the 1970s. And I remember reading a while back about Savitri Devi, who is a sort of not necessarily totally anti-civ, but just... Okay, so she was a Nazi, and she converted to Hinduism and was searching for the pan-Aryan roots of, you know, Western religion. She wrote a book called The Impeachment of Man, and it's essentially a deep ecology writing. And she talks about how anthropocentrism is destructive, and of course tracks it back to Jewish thought in the Old Testament about nature being on earth for the use of humans.
Naturally.
Of course, but that modernity amplifies anthropocentrism and gives it an egoistic rationale, glorifying self-interest. And that sort of illustrates the lack of connection with the larger natural and social whole. She saw liberalism as the key enemy of the survival of the human species and of the environment, essentially. So basically, there's this whole eco-fascist movement that comes out of her thought. It really plays into things like the idea that human biodiversity needs to be maintained and that society needs to be taken back to one that's based on a pre-modern structure. So it's like, you know, a lot of that stuff is stuff that deep green sort of anarchists say, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, there's a critique of even the very notion of wilderness as like putting humans and human civilizations on one side and wilderness on the other, and then having this as a sort of dichotomy where, you know, you can either be in favor of humans and civilization or you can be in favor of wilderness, which is the world outside of humanity. And you know, one can be positioned somewhere along this spectrum, even if you didn't call it a sort of binary, if you had a spectrum and one could follow along this spectrum and position yourselves, you know, more in favor of one side or the other. This very framing, this entire framework, the notion of wilderness itself is a racist product of Western imperialism. The notion that there is humans who are civilized and are over here, and wilderness that humans aren't in, was a concept that grew out of like imperial powers invading places that they regarded as uncivilized, and saw these areas of land that they regarded as wild, but in reality, there were always humans there, and they lived in a very like you know, they lived in an integrated fashion with their environments in a sustainable fashion, in a healthy metabolic relationship, one might say. This is John Bellamy Foster's thesis that the way that we need to think about it is not in terms of do we value wilderness or do we value human civilization, but rather we have to recognize that human beings, like all organisms, exist in a metabolic relationship with their surroundings and with other organisms. The structure of the society that we currently live in is one in which creates a what he calls an ecological rift in that metabolic relationships between humans and their surroundings, so that we're constantly pulling resources out of the world and dumping waste into the world in an unsustainable fashion. But what we should be focused on is not necessarily a valuation of wilderness devoid of humanity, but rather rationalizing our society to the point that it's not, you know, driven by the anarchy of the market, but that it's so that it's driven by the conscious human direction and human recognition of our own metabolic relationship with the world.
Well, so Kaczynski basically advocates for human beings to return to like live in the way that what he refers to as primitive people, but he tries to like sort of rescue the word primitive from its negative connotations that are given it to by like European imperialism, right? And he says like we should live like primitive people because those are the people who live in symbiotic harmonious relations with the planet. It's not exactly the same thing as advocating for the destruction of civilization, really. He's advocating for a period of civilization. He's advocating for civilization's prehistory, band level societies or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think, you know, I think there's something to be said. There's a part of me that wants to say the anti-civ account of the world is perfectly in line with a Marxist account of the development of class society, that of what Marx and Engels called primitive communism is exactly what these people, what anti-civ people are advocating for. The only difference is that they don't think that there's any way that industrial society is unfixable. There's no way to fix it. There's no way to bring about a post-technological communist society. The only way to return to a state that doesn't put all of humanity at enemy in a position of being enemies with themselves and their own natural condition is to return to hunter-gatherer societies.
And so the green fascists, that man's natural state, and I could say man because they're fascists and they would say man, you know. if I used inclusive language here, I would just be being disingenuous to the point they're trying to get across.
Yeah.
But anyway, so humankind's natural state is one of hierarchy and one of, you know, a somewhat agrarian or tribal society that is still agrarian, that where the natural state of human beings is to work the land, to hunt, and then be ruled by the smartest and best people, and that's what humanity should, you know, return to. So it's similar, but it places the ideal point to which they hearken back a few thousand years later. You know what I mean? Like they don't advocate hunter-gatherer societies. They advocate small-scale civilization.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. This would be one of my disagreements with the Unabomber, is that among many, right? Like for example, mailing people bombs is bad, but also
he just mailed them to the wrong people.
He should have hand delivered them.
But also, like,
that's the problem.
I think that, you know, it takes quite an intellectual leap and somersault even to sort of acknowledge the trajectory of human development. That is to say, that the advent of civilization. To acknowledge that this is a series of sometimes conscious decisions and often and largely unconscious processes unleashed by them. And then to have arrived at a point and then say, oh, we have to stop, we have to go back. It takes quite a leap, I think, because what you're saying is that, like, next time we just won't do it. And I think that that's, you know, that's what Marxists we would call idealism, but, you know, with the negative connotation it has in this particular discourse. Because the notion is that somehow, you know, by hitting the reset button on the game, that you're not going to have to play through the levels all the same ways again. That people, you know, that people aren't going to, like, want to see even as their eyesight begins to fail them, right? That they're not going to invent glasses. You know, that people aren't going to want to preserve meat so that they can eat even whenever it gets really cold outside. So, you know what I mean? Like, I am not an advocate of the horrifying society that we live in. But what I found early on in my youth, and I still find to be lacking in the anti-civ critiques, and I have to admit that I'm not nearly as familiar with them as Kevin or Jenny. But what I've always found lacking is just, like, answers to the basic things, like how do you check the what seems to be the natural human impulse to, like, invent and to make life easier by virtue of inventing.
I think what's really interesting and troubling to me too is this, like, I don't know that it's weird. I on some level understand the desire to, like, really harp on what is natural to humans and to the environment. But I think that it is a common thread in like anti-civ and primitivist and, like, you know, green anarchists to harp on it so much that it leads them to, like, really turfy places.
Yeah.
So it's
interesting. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's really interesting to me, you know, how so much of the left has chosen to take up this language of, like, what is natural and who's born this way and, you know, things that are, like, biological determinism that end up actually hurting a lot of the, you know, ideas we make because they seem like more convenient and easier arguments to make.
Sure.
And then these sorts of folks take them and run fucking wild with them. That's just always kind of blown my mind about how they can end up in such a disastrous and harmful place when we're talking about, you know, trans folks. And I think that it even bleeds over into, you know, the ways a lot of them talk about sex workers. What the fuck is wrong with them? What's their problem?
I mean, just to, like, really, you know, I want to make sure that I don't come across as one of those people that's like, oh, you don't like the way technology's ruined the Earth, but you're saying it on an iPhone, you know? Because sure. Those are actually the worst people.
Yeah.
Are they the worst ones?
Well, they're competing with the people who say, if you have an iPhone, then you're responsible for killing all the birds. But, like, I have a sympathy, you know, like, modernity is awful.
Yeah.
Sure.
I think, absolutely. You know, I sit in my car on the freeway in my hour-long commute every day to go to the office. And, like, I think about, you know, oh, yeah, like, all of this could go. Because, you know what's fun? It's camping. Like, I like it. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. But I can't, you know, I can't bring myself to adopt the logic that what needs to happen is that everyone has to go camping forever. Even if
you know what else
6
is?
Billion or so of the people who are alive are going to have to die as a result. Yeah. Like, there's just...
One of my favorite things to do when camping is to read a book in nature.
Mm. Yeah.
And guess what creates books? Yeah. Printing presses. And guess what those
technology.
Are?
Technology.
Machines.
Technology.
Yeah. Hell yeah,
guess what
brother!
What makes books so readily available? And that's mass production. But anyway, well,
this is why I'm a romantic, pessimistic Marxist, because I can't square the circle between the the production industrial civilization has been a disaster for humanity. Yeah. And
yeah,
but you know,
it's absolutely true.
So is, you know, getting killed by a lion because you can't see.
That's the first place you went.
So,
not my best work, I'll admit.
I like it.
A lot of fascists would say that we need to get back to the idea that if you're not selected to carry on the species, then you don't deserve to survive, mm-hmm. right? So if you have bad eyesight and get eaten by a lion, that's just natural selection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? I mean, that's true. That's what it is.
Right. So that's like, to them, That's the eugenics that Hitler and, you know, the 19th and 20th century Western scientists were trying to do, just happening naturally. And I've actually heard this said by green anarchists as well, you know? They agree on that point.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, you know, not everybody's going to get to live. Some people are going to die in childbirth. They weren't selected to carry on the species. And, I don't know. I just, when reading about all of this stuff, I just kept finding all of these, like, incredibly close parallels mm-hmm. to fascism.
Sure.
Absolutely.
You know? Well, like, call me a speciesist, but one of the things that is most easily, to me, like, celebrated about this particular species that I belong to is that we have developed the capacity for abstract thought that has allowed us to cheat evolution, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty great.
Well, we didn't cheat evolution. We just
well, we evolved is what we did.
Big ass
brains. Well, John,
hacked evolution.
John Zerzan, if you read his article "No Way Out," he argues that or symbolic thought, maybe
what
not abstract.
What am I thinking right now, Kevin?
I don't know.
Well, that's because you fucking have devolved. Oh.
Well, he said the symbolic thought is precisely the problem. That's where humanity went wrong. That's where we went wrong was symbolic thought. Modern, he alleges that modern, or argues that the modern human in its biological form existed for whatever it was, tens of thousands of years, prior to any anthropological record of representation. So, like, cave drawings and or anything like that didn't come until way, like, thousands and tens of thousands of years after modern human like, yeah, was around and doing shit. And he alleges, like, this is the problem. When you stop engaging with the world that is and start representing it, that's where humanity started going in, diverting itself into abstracting out ways of using abstract thought and, like, constructing ways of manipulating the world around them to create technology, and, you know, hence the advent of agriculture, and hence all of our problems of inequality and warfare, right, and everything comes from representation, symbolic thought. So exactly what...
It's like, in the process of doing that, we lost the ability to communicate through... telepathically communicate.
Did he say that? Yeah. I thought...
No, he absolutely said that. And he shows examples of people who observe telepathic communication in the Kalahari with the Bush tribes of Bushmen.
Oh, wow.
And I was just like, hold up.
See, like, that's that special...
You're a serious person, and I need some footnotes, you know? Because I would like to take you seriously, but you're making this real hard right now.
That's a special kind of racism where you, like, you take a population that's different than yours and you elevate them to the status of warlocks. You're like, they're so different than us. They can, you know.
That's like classic Orientalism, you know, right?
Exactly. It's an archetype of the noble savage that, you know, represents the best of our species because of its simplicity, because it has not been caught up in the trappings of excess and luxury and modernity and, like, philosophy, right, of, like, abstract thought, like the capacity to comprehend existence. Somehow that's meant to be a compliment.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right, though, Chris, about continuing to go back to comparisons with third positionism and different forms of fascism, because, you know, coming with this, you know, sort of what I was kind of describing earlier about there's something about anti-civ politics that necessitates rejecting leftism that necessarily means that you're trying to transcend the left-right dichotomy, and necessarily means that you are recognizing an affinity, at least some degree of affinity with the right wing. And so, like, this, like, weird infusion of right wing ideas is pervasive in a lot of this anti-civ politics. And Jenny, like what you were saying earlier about them being, like, turfy or whatever, that's Deep Green Resistance's, like, chief conflict with the left is they are out and out old fashioned 1970s radical feminists who don't think that trans identity is a real thing.
Not that they don't think it's a real thing. They think it's, like, trying that it's worse than not a real thing. They think it's men trying to become women so they can encroach on women's spaces.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot to unpack. Well, you know, it's not, I mean, so it is politics. The thing is, they see it as, like, an anti-politics. So they're disgusted with the political landscape as it stands, because, like, of course, it's disgusting. But, you know, in the same way that they think that they can drop off the grid in a lot of ways in terms of, like, lifestyle politics, like, it's still a politic to disengage and to think that, like, ideology is pervasive enough that, like, you don't actually have to contend for power, especially when you're wanting to, like, reinvent modern civilization or destroy it. You know, I have a lot of feelings, obviously.
Right. So, you know, I think I think one of the best instantiations of green anarchy was the Earth Liberation Front, the ELF, which apparently was, at least in the U.S., it was the only people who were enacting successful, you know, amounts of or significant amounts of successful acts of property destruction. It was pretty much isolated to a single cell of individuals here in the Pacific Northwest in the 90s. And once the FBI caught that group of people, it all stopped. Nobody else really took up the mantle and tried to do it more. There was some parallel stuff going on in Europe that was apparently more successful, and they got away with it and kept doing stuff. But here in the U.S., it stopped with just that one group. Yes.
Well, it was an SUV dealership, I think, but more or less same shit.
Yeah, yeah. I remember reading about that when we were on tour and thinking, oh, that's fucking dope.
Yeah. Yeah, that was their main thing that they would do. That one of their founding principles was take all possible precautions to protect life and target the worst environmental destroyers. You know, the people who or the organizations, the entities, the social infrastructure that is destroying the environment, this thing that we all rely on. And they would set up little bombs or whatever in the middle of the night, and they would never hurt anybody, and they would just destroy property. They would destroy loggers. They would they burn down the SUV dealership or whatever it was. They burned they arsoned like a whole bunch of like different headquarters and different stuff like that. But they got caught because there was one guy who was in the know, who was a part of their inner workings, a guy named Jacob Ferguson. And he was a heroin addict. And because of his heroin addiction, the FBI targeted him, caught him, threatened him with, you know, basically, you know, spending the rest of his life in prison. And so he agreed to rat on the rest of them, but not just rat on them, wear a wire and go talk to all of them about everything that they had done. So the FBI then got a bunch of them on tape talking about the stuff that they had done. Just like, you know, like you would commiserate with an old friend or whatever and talking about stuff.
Years later, too. This wasn't like, you know, weeks or months after.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was years
later. Man, y'all remember those crimes? So good.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, and they talk about, like, you listen to the activists talking about it, and they say exactly that they felt like it was kind of weird, and he was, like, trying to push conversation about stuff, but he was, you know, he was an old friend, and they also knew that he had, like, addiction problems, and so they just kind of chalked it up to him being weird and having issues with his, you know, addiction or whatever. But they would have gotten away with it. They would have gotten away with it. They all would have gotten away with it if it weren't for having that one weak link.
Okay, but he wasn't the only one who narked.
Well, no, I, well,
more it was, of them ended up caving.
Yeah, a couple of them made deals and testified against the other ones in exchange for not dying in prison. But they, the other ones who narked were only ever caught because they were caught by this guy recording them, going around and recording them because the FBI got him. But I, you know, so like here, you know, my thing is, I think terrorism's a bad idea. I think trying to like change society by, well, I wouldn't even call that this shit terrorism. But anyway, I think trying to take individual acts of property destruction is not how you're going to change the world. You're not going to change anything. You're just going to feel like you know, it's white saviorism or whatever. It's people who
it's substitutionism.
Yeah. Yeah, and voluntarism, the measure of seriousness, I think, of a radical is not their willingness to engage in radical tactics, but rather their willingness to subject themselves to the boring, thankless daily work of just fucking organizing your community. That's how you change the world. But climate change changes the picture. We don't have time to just wait until we successfully organize to change society into a some sort of sustainable post-capitalist industrial society. We are living through what will be increasing social crises, but also the sixth great mass extinction event is happening right now. Yeah. And that's fucking horrific. And I just can't bring myself to condemn people who are willing to do something serious about stopping that.
Yeah, right. Hell no. And I think for me, the thing that is most important to highlight is that, like, my disagreement isn't a moral one. I don't have any issues with their actions. No. I can't wait until that's on the internet for everyone to hear.
Miss Jenny, I heard you talking about blowing up trucks.
Listen, I don't have any moral disagreements with their actions. What my issue is a strategic one and a political one, is that, like, did their actions actually advance anything that we're trying to do in terms of building, in terms of, like, destroying this shitty fucking system that is destroying this shitty fucking planet? And no, ultimately, you know, I think in some ways it may have set us behind because of what surveillance looks like now. The shitty surveillance state that we live in now, which is not to say, obviously, like, before ELF, like, COINTELPRO was a thing. I'm definitely not making the argument that, like, we weren't being watched before and that the CIA wasn't listening to our podcast or whatever. I, like, surely that was a thing, but, you know, I don't know. And I hate to say that because I know that these types of folks sacrificed a great deal, and I'm sitting in a fairly comfortable position to be able to, I'm not in prison yet, you know, to be able to criticize these sorts of tactics and strategies, but, you know, I can't help but feel like they haven't propelled us.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There were anti-terrorism laws that were passed specifically to target environmental activists subsequent to, to the 90s, this you know, whatever rash of 90s arsons. But I think you're right that the criticism to be had of it is that it didn't change society. But I think we change society by organizing, but I also think that we are out of time to be able to wait until we change society to stop environmental destruction. And I think it is actually commendable for people to go out and blow up fossil fuel infrastructure.
Lenin said that, you know, anarchism is the consequence of opportunism on the part of social democracy, or to use contemporary terms, it's, you know, if the left can't, you know, significantly mobilize the working class population to, you know, seize power, end capitalism, save the planet, then the result is going to be people who are frustrated and, like, aware of the fact that the world is crumbling and burning up right in front of their eyes, and that maybe they can't fix anything, but they can at least, like, make a stand, right? They can make a statement. Like, that is the logical outcome of, you know, left-wing governments adapting to neoliberal pressures rather than nationalizing fossil fuel industries, right? That's the reason why this stuff comes up when it does in such a big way in the late 70s through the 90s, is because it's, you know, at the receding edge of a revolutionary wave, which didn't achieve anything. And so, of course, when you look at, like, ecological catastrophe looming, not just looming, but presently playing out in front of our eyes, it makes sense that there's a new generation of people who are seeking, you know, finding inspiration in similar bold acts of defiant desperation. Because, Kevin, yeah, you're right. Like, it doesn't really feel like we have time to, like, relearn the lessons of the 20th century.
Yeah.
I had a tanky tell me one time that he thought anarchists engaging in terrorism was a good thing because it sort of accelerates the conditions that put the squeeze on activists and sort of like strips away a whole layer of useless activists who aren't going to do anything and who aren't serious about revolution. And I thought that was the dumbest shit I've ever heard.
Yeah, and, I was going to say, what?
he used the example of the Narodnaya Volya killing the Tsar and the repression that resulted from that as spurning the Russian people into greater revolutionary action. And Lenin's brother being hung, sparking Lenin's revolutionary career.
Yeah, I mean, that is a conclusion that you could draw if you have a really specific read on history and the role of the individual in it. But,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's not the one that I have.
Well, I mean, history is just a formula that we have to recreate.
Oh, that's right, that's right.
If Marxism tells us anything, right?
Right. Yeah, just keep role-playing the fucking 1917 Russian Revolution until it happens again, right?
The only problem is figuring out who's going to be Lenin. If we could just figure that out, then we could hang his brother and everything will just pop off.
I don't have a brother.
Hey, everyone. I just wanted to drop in really quickly and let you know that we have created a Patreon. We are trying to defray some of the costs of hosting our podcast, and we would like to expand our content in the future, but we're going to need some money in order to do that. We would also like to be able to afford some new microphones and a mixing board to be able to do one-on-one in-person interviews. So if you feel so inclined, go on over to patreon.com/theregrettablecentury and sign up on the only tier that we have available right now for $2. In the future, we'll have a second tier that has some exclusive content, but we would like for you guys to help us figure out what that is going to be. So please leave us suggestions on our Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, which can all be found by searching for The Regrettable Century. Also, remember to subscribe, review, and rate us on the iTunes podcast app if you use that. And yes, please tell your friends. All right, back to the episode. Thanks. We definitely talked about the uni bomber.
No, it was the guy who the mime hater who went around blowing up unicycles. Yeah, absolutely.
Critical support for the uni bomber. Okay, let's actually talk about Deep Green Resistance a little bit more in depth. Because we've talked about them.
They hurt my feelings.
And the turfiness, but that's actually...
And swerfiness.
It's a big issue, right? But it's a very tiny part of their platform, you know? And it's actually surprising to me that that's the hill they chose to fucking die on,
yeah.
Right?
It's well, they see it. They say that an industrial civilization, patriarchy, and something else are like the trifecta that are the problem. And the way that they confront patriarchy is by saying that men have to follow women, leadership, and that women are defined in a specific way. And so it's central to the way they see the way forward, you know?
The binary is, like, integral to their entire, like, shitty outlook. You know, they just, like, felt their grip and relevance just fading away. And I think this is one of the few ways they have to, like, maintain any sort of audience, good or bad, to be able to get the rest of their lackluster.
I mean, I think it shows how like the broader discourse in society cannot help but impact, you know, a group that, you know, intends to exist outside of it, right? Because they are human beings plugged into the society that they're a part of. And as reactionaries, they have absorbed reactionary ideology.
Yeah. So trans issues are super important issues, right? But trans people are a very, very, very small portion of the population, right? Like not even a full percentage point. And if Deep Green Resistance is so concerned with the end of the world, why isn't that something that they could just wait to deal with later, right? It blows my mind. I just don't understand. I mean, there is a hatred there that is driving this, and that's what it really is. It's like, it's a fear. It's a loathing. It's not, I don't believe that anyone actually thinks what they think, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that they've convinced themselves that that's what they think because it makes them feel better.
Right. Right. Well, I actually went on a date one time with a woman who told me that she was been a member of Deep Green Resistance and was the person who for DGR and she. I discovered this during the course of the date, but I brought up the trans thing, and her response was like, you know, like this was the organization's position on this issue, but we never wanted it to, none of us ever wanted it to be like our defining issue. We were happy to work with people that we disagreed with on this and just move forward, and it was fine. It's that other anarchists or whatever wouldn't tolerate us because we had
this. It's kind of like the Strasser brothers with anti-Semitism.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, this is kind of a crucial little bit here, you know? But it became practical for their organization because there was like a member who was in their organization who, identified as a woman who had been assigned male at birth, and it became a problem because they were going on a retreat or whatever, and they were having separated sleeping spaces. They had women-only sleeping spaces, and one of the questions that they asked people was, have you ever experienced male privilege? And if you've ever experienced male privilege, then you are not allowed in women-only spaces. And so they told this person, this woman, that she's not allowed in the women-only space. She left, ended up leaving the organization and post, you know, you can read her account or whatever online. Up to that point, they were, you know, had no issues with this person being a member of their organization. They only made it an issue whenever, like,
when they needed to enforce their Christian summer camp rules.
Yeah.
For sure not.
I was going to say it sounds like they were pretty heavily infiltrated by the FBI.
They're fucking weird. They got
yikes.
They've been run out of all left spaces out here in the Pacific Northwest anyway.
As well they should be.
They boasted a 200,000 member 200,000 people as members, right? At one point.
Oh, yeah, me too. I have 200,000 members.
Well, shit, dude.
It's too many. It's too many.
Anyway.
Obviously, the point I'm making is there's not a chance in hell that Deep Green Resistance had 200,000 members. You would have felt the impact a little bit more, I think.
Did I read that wrong?
No, you didn't. That's what they said, but they're just
lying.
Like,
bullshit.
Lying. I was just,
maybe they just all dropped out of everything, so that's why we don't know them.
They talk about the need to maintain contacts for people who are living off the grid, to maintain contacts with people in universities and people with access to technology and lawyers and people like that. You know, so they need moles living in industrial society in order to be able to exist outside of society, which, think about how much they could accomplish if they just stayed inside of society and didn't have to, like, have proxies acting for them, you know? Have all 200,000 of them, you know? It'd be the biggest political party in the United States if they just all got together and put their names on a piece of paper, right?
Well, it's kind of like what Kaczynski says in Industrial Society and Its Future when he talks about, like, the particular pathologies of the left, which keeps them from being able to, like, accomplish things because of, like, a particular need for, like, hostility and rage and like, you know, he says his example is affirmative action. And he's like, and if people on the left really think affirmative action is so important for black people, then they would be trying to figure out a way to make the case to racist whites rather than saying, you don't like it, you're racist. Like, they would appeal to them in terms of their own self-interest. Like, here's why, even if you don't like it, it's a good thing, right? Which is funny, because Kaczynski is a person who, you know, he takes, let's call it an extreme approach to making his point.
Let's call it that.
I agree with the Ted Kaczynski method in teaching racist whites not to be racist.
Right, right, like... Look, you don't like affirmative action.
You don't like affirmative action. Yeah. Please sign for this package.